abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
And hello, everybody, on this Thursday, October 3rd, 2013. Today I'm riding solo on the show. Once in a while I want to just comment on something, and y'all know these days I've got so much going on. This Ron Paul homeschool curriculum is just murdering me. I mean, it's unbelievable. Every course, I need to do 180 videos because it's 36 weeks, 5 lessons per week, 20 to 25 minutes each per lesson. If you'd like to get a sense of what I'm covering in Western Civ 1 that is sapping the life out of me, in a good cause, by the way, check out tomwoods.com/Western Civ. So what this means is that in the old days of like 3 months ago, I used to be able to see an article and then I could write a blog post and with my response and it would be great. I'd be happy and satisfied and I could go about my day and not feel that I had left something undone. But now I just haven't got the writing time that I used to have, and it's going to be that way for a little while longer because I have more homeschool courses to prepare. But that's important work, and I'm glad I'm doing it. I'm not complaining. I'm glad I'm doing it. But now that I have this half-hour show, it gives me the opportunity to get things off my chest in just half an hour. So there is a topic I want to hit on today, and that's nullification. So if you're sick and tired of hearing about nullification, you can just press stop on the podcast now. But I want to talk in particular about the Heritage Foundation, which you may say, oh, the Heritage Foundation, they do wonderful work, right? They're a D.C. think tank, and they're conservative, and they're really trying to promote small government, and you should support that. Well, I don't go around looking to pick fights with people. I don't go around trying to make enemies. I don't go around trying to nitpick people. I tend to be relatively big tent in that if I see people who are kind of on the right track, I figure, well, you know, I'll befriend them and maybe I can make them be even more on the right track, whatever. I'm not really looking to be a maniacal or single-minded or whatever, but I feel like with an organization like the Heritage Foundation, which is geared toward conservatives and which people associate in their minds with constitutionalism, when they're wrong, it's got to be pointed out because they're misleading an enormous number of people, and they have been consistently unhelpful, to put it mildly, on the subject of state nullification of unconstitutional federal laws. And if you're listening to this program, you know this is a cause that I've been associated with for some time, particularly since 2010 when I wrote a book called Nullification. And they've done this repeatedly. Now they've got this article, it's their issue brief. I guess they do this periodically, an issue brief. And it's by a guy named Evan Burnick, and it's called Two Constitutional Wrongs Don't Make a Right: Why Conservatives Should Just Say No to Nullification. And I just want to go through this and reply to it. And I'm not going to be mean. I'm not going to be name-calling. I just want to go through point by point because I think the types of arguments you encounter here are the types of arguments you're liable to encounter anywhere. I mean, they're the same sort of arguments you would see Rachel Maddow making. They're the same kind of arguments that maybe Chris Matthews, anybody on MSNBC might make these arguments, and yet here they are coming from the Heritage Foundation. So unfortunately, on the question of nullification, it's Heritage Foundation and Rachel Maddow sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. I don't know if the kids still say that or not. That's what they used to say in my day. If you want to follow along as I go through this piece, feel free to do so. I haven't linked it anywhere, so I'm not making it easy on you, but you can just type Heritage Foundation nullification, and this article by Evan Burnick should come up. You can follow along. So the article starts off by saying, yes, it's understandable that the states might want to push back against the federal government because we all know the federal government is doing things that aren't authorized in the Constitution. All right, good. But now here we go. We have this section of the paper, and it's called The History of Nullification. So we're about to get a history lesson here. Historically, this section begins, nullification has an ignominious lineage. Ignominious, that means like shameful. Ignominious lineage. So, well, what do they mean by that? Its chief architect was John C. Calhoun, former vice president, secretary of war and state, and U.S. senator from South Carolina, who used the concept of nullification to defend states' rights against federal tariffs and, ultimately, challenges to the institution of slavery. Well, of course, ultimately allows you to say anything about anybody. This, of course, never had anything whatsoever to do with slavery, the issue of nullification. And if you've listened to me at any length, you know that one of the points that I've made over and over is that the only time slavery ever came up in connection with nullification was against slavery, was the battle against slavery. The abolitionists actually used Calhoun's arguments in favor of state nullification, and they cited him by name. They didn't say, oh, nullification has an ignominious lineage because of its association with Calhoun. No, their view was, look, if Calhoun's right about something, then good, right? Let's just cite him. If he's right, then we like that part about what he stands for. And if he's wrong about something else, we don't like that. It wasn't this kind of fanatical situation we have today where somebody's wrong on one thing and he is to be shunned by all respectable society. So the abolitionists even cited him by name when fighting against, for example, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And in the nullification book, I explain the different aspects of that law that were considered to be unconstitutional by some people. Even though there is a Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution, that does not mean the federal government is therefore empowered to do absolutely anything whatsoever on behalf of slavery. And so we had, I think most famously, although this is not the only case, but in Wisconsin, we had the case of Joshua Glover, who's also, I also talk about it a little bit in the book, but Joshua Glover was a runaway slave, and when the federal officials caught up with him, the Wisconsinites, or I don't know, Wisconsinians, whatever they call themselves, they all demanded that he be given a proper jury trial, that we're not going to let some slave catcher just come into our state and yank some guy away just simply because they say, well, he meets the physical description of the guy we're looking for. Oh, I'm sure that's being observed super carefully, right? No potential for abuse there. No, we want to give this guy a jury trial. Well, eventually, a mob wound up freeing him from jail, and he wound up getting away, and that was the end of it. We don't hear from him in history again after that point. This is in the 1850s. And the Wisconsin legislature and the Wisconsin State Supreme Court both quoted from the Virginia resolutions, or I beg your pardon, from the Kentucky resolutions of 1798 and 1799. The Kentucky resolutions of 1798 were drafted by Thomas Jefferson, and they go on to quote the whole thing about a nullification is the rightful remedy, and that of a law that's unconstitutional is null, void, and of no force or effect. They quote this verbatim from Jefferson in the state Supreme Court, and then the state legislature backs up its state Supreme Court, says, yes, we absolutely endorse what our state Supreme Court is doing. And when they handed out handbills discussing the urgency of defending Joshua Glover, those handbills said things like, we have to defend our state sovereignty against these terrible federal marshals who are coming into our state and threatening to violate the rights of people like Joshua Glover. So the only connection between slavery and nullification is that nullification was used to fight against slavery. Now, this is the opposite of what you'll get from TV, but you don't need me to tell you that. I assume that's your running assumption, as it ought to be. But then in addition to that, in terms of nullification and slavery, we might also note anytime people say that you're some kind of a neo-Confederate. Ooh, right? Oh, my heavens. Not that. I'm a neo-Confederate. That's a term they never define, right? What do they mean by this? They mean I want to dig up Jefferson Davis's dead body and like make him president again? Like, what? I don't even know what they mean by this Marxoid term. But when they say that, they're once again showing that they don't really have a good grasp of the history, because it turns out that nullification is not a Southern doctrine per se. And in particular, we might note two fairly obvious points in favor of this side of things. For one thing, when Jefferson Davis, who later became the president of the Confederate States of America, gave his his farewell address to the U.S. Senate, where he served, he denounced nullification. He didn't say, well, this is a great Southern principle and we can't wait to put it into effect. No, he denounced it. And likewise, South Carolina, December 20th, 1860, when it issued its official proclamation of secession, it included as one of its grievances the fact that it was sick and tired of the North nullifying so much. So this was not a Southern doctrine, but it was not a Northern doctrine. It was an American doctrine that found support all in regions all over the country. In fact, I cite in the book, around 1820, the legislature of Ohio, which you'll note did not go on to become part of the Southern Confederacy, actually voted on a resolution indicating that it was their belief that the principles of 1798, named after the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions outlining the strategy of nullification, were shared and believed in by a majority of Americans. Well, interesting. So it turns out that the reality is a little bit more interesting and nuanced than the comic book version. So, all right, so it has an ignominious lineage because it was supposedly used to fight against challenges to the institution of slavery. There were no such challenges during Calhoun's lifetime, so I have no idea what they could possibly have in mind here, other than just repeating the kind of traditional progressive view that anything involving the states must implicitly have something to do with slavery somewhere along the line. I don't think that's the way that a conservative organization that's taking money from conservative donors ought to be speaking. But he also used it to defend states' rights against federal tariffs. Well, why is that an ignominious lineage? Right now, you could make an argument that the tariffs Calhoun was fighting against in 1832 and 1833 in South Carolina, when he wound up resigning as vice president, he runs for the open seat in South Carolina, or he's elected as a U.S. senator from South Carolina after that, that these tariffs are not actually unconstitutional. He tried to make a constitutional distinction between tariffs for revenue and protective tariffs. Tariffs for revenue, he believed, were constitutional. You can see in the Constitution, tariffs are okay. If they're intended for revenue purposes, for funding the government. But he argued that if the tariffs are levied for some other purpose, if they are put down for the purpose of interfering with competition, if they're intending to, for example, protect some firms from foreign competition, or the purpose of the tariff, and this is more to Calhoun's point, if the purpose of the tariff is to protect one section of the country against the other, to benefit one section of the country, the industrial North, at the expense of the agricultural South, he argued this was unconstitutional because this violated the general welfare requirement, because this type of tariff would not be in support of the general welfare. It would be aimed at building up the welfare of just one section of the country. Now, this may be a good argument. It may not be. There is some evidence that, indeed, the federal government was intended to have the power to lay a tariff for these other purposes. But regardless, I mean, why would you say that this is ignominious that somebody tries to fight federal tariffs? That's great, right? Wouldn't we all want to do that? Like, why would you feel sorry about that? All right, anyway, let me get more to the point here. Here's a passage I think is quite revealing. After 1787, he says, the several states were not independent sovereigns. For instance, they could not wage war, maintain diplomatic relations with foreign nations, or coin their own money. All right, let's pause right there. So what he's saying is, look, you nullification people, you seem to think that the states are like independent countries. They have independent sovereign power. But that's clearly not the case, because look, under the Constitution, the states were not allowed to do certain things that we associate with sovereignty, like waging war or coining money, and et cetera, et cetera. The problem with this argument is that the states delegated certain powers to the federal government, yes, and they voluntarily agreed to, in their own case, restrain themselves from doing certain things by their own voluntary agreements. But again, as I've shown in some of my writing, for example, if you were to visit nullificationfaq.com, which is my Nullification Frequently Asked Questions page, I elaborate on this. If you look at somebody like Emmerich de Vattel, who was one of the great international law theorists of or the theorist of what was at that time called the Law of Nations in the 18th century. What he said is that a state does not become any less sovereign when it, by its own voluntary agreement, decides not to exercise certain powers. Well, that's when it enters into something like, for example, the United States of America. Now, I added in that last part, but that's the point, is that the states here, as I'll show in a minute, they did begin as the repositories of sovereignty. The peoples of the states were where the sovereign power was reposed. That's where it all started. And then, yes, because they thought it was to their own advantage for all of them simultaneously to relinquish certain powers and to voluntarily agree not to exercise them, that doesn't make them any less sovereign. It was their decision to do that. It was they were exercising their sovereignty when they said we will choose not to exercise these certain powers. So he's not actually proving anything. They did that by their own sovereign decision. They chose to limit themselves. But if they are sovereign, then they can remove those limits anytime they want to. They can resume their full powers anytime they want to. They have not impaired their sovereignty. Sovereignty is not alienable. Once you're sovereign, you're sovereign. And so I guess now I should probably demonstrate this. And I've done this on many occasions, but I have a post, if you were to Google it, you'll find it. If you were to Google, is nullification unconstitutional? One of the first posts that comes up is by me. I have an article on this. And part of the answer to that question involves figuring out where the sovereign power actually lies. And it turns out that it lies not in the federal government and not in the state governments. The idea that a government could be sovereign was one of the old world European ideas that Americans were trying to run away from. Now, to the contrary, the American idea was that the peoples of the states were sovereign. So when we talk about state sovereignty, this is just shorthand for this idea that it is the peoples of the states. So the people of Massachusetts, the people of Virginia, the people of New York, there is, strictly speaking, no such thing as the American people. Certainly not in 1776, and arguably not in 1787 either. What you instead have is a collection of societies. Not a great big blob. You have a collection of societies, and you see that in the text of the Constitution itself, in which the United States is consistently referred to, not in the singular, not as if the United States is one big blob. It's always referred to in the plural. The United States are, emphasizing that what we have here is a collection of sovereignties, not one giant blob. A collection of sovereignties is not a sovereignty. Like a collection of country clubs is not a country club. These peoples are the sovereigns. Now, I'll demonstrate that to you in a minute. But the point is that we see this reflected in the text of the Constitution. And then also later on, Article 6, we see reference to the Constitution taking effect between the states who ratify it. Between the states. That's what it is. It is a compact between the states. It's not a giant blob. It's a compact between states. And when we look back in American history, we see this. All through the colonial period, there was no one single American people that was sovereign. There was no colony that had the power to impose laws on other colonies. And in the early period after the Declaration of Independence, there was no state that had the power to legislate for another state. Every single one was completely independent of the other one in terms of its internal affairs. Everyone was independent of everybody else. We look at the Declaration of Independence. It speaks of free and independent states in the plural. Now remember, what does state mean in the 18th century? State in the 18th century doesn't mean what we think of today when we hear state. We think of Massachusetts as a state. We think of Vermont as a state. But when they said state in the 18th century, they meant France. They meant something like France. They meant Spain. That's what they meant by a free and independent state that has all the powers that a sovereign state has and can do all the things that a sovereign state may of right do. So free and independent states in the plural. Then in the Treaty of Paris, when the war comes to an end and peace is established between the British and the Americans, how is it done? It's done in the form of a treaty establishing peace not with a single blob, but a peace treaty with Massachusetts, Virginia, again, recognizing that what you have is a collection of societies. So notice that these societies exist before there is a U.S. government, before there is a U.S. Constitution. They're already there. And then we already saw, again, very early, the colonies slash states exercising powers that we associate with sovereignty. And again, if you go to nullificationfaq.com or you look up my piece, Is Nullification Unconstitutional? I go through examples of this. Example after example, you got states outfitting ships to cruise against the British. You got you have New Hampshire authorizing its executive to issue letters of marque and reprisal. You have the laws against treason being drafted and being thought of, treason being thought of as a crime committed not against a single blob, but against the states individually, because those are the constituent parts of the Union. Then when the before we even get to the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation is the document, of course, that precedes the Constitution. Now, that's drafted in 1777. It's not finally ratified because of Maryland being a holdout till 1781. And that says in Article 2 that the states retain their sovereignty, freedom, and independence. Now, how could they retain their sovereignty, freedom, and independence if they didn't have them to begin with? So again, this again shows that that's where the sovereignty is. And so it's the peoples of the states who begin as the sovereigns, and then they apportion their sovereign powers between the state governments and the federal government. They are exercising their sovereignty when they do this. They're not impairing sovereignty. They're exercising it. And so that answers our question. The states preceded the federal government. The states were acting like states, were acting like sovereigns before there was a federal government. In their sovereign capacity, they delegated certain powers to the federal government, and in their sovereign capacity, they agreed not to exercise certain powers, but they're still sovereign. You're still the sovereign over your household, even if you say, well, look, from now on, everybody, I'm going to try not to raise my voice. Well, it's annoying to raise your voice, but strictly speaking, you can still do it, right? Because you're the sovereign. So what we ultimately are left with then is, I think, the most telling aspect of this whole question is when the Constitution was up to be for ratification, how was it ratified? Did we have a vote of the whole so-called American people? No, there's no such thing. All there are the peoples of the states. And so each one of the peoples of the states voted on whether or not to ratify the Constitution. And in the states, they had special state ratifying conventions for this purpose, because it was part of Republican, small r, political theory in the United States that the highest, well, let's say in America, the highest sovereign voice of the people is reflected in a special convention. Not in the legislature, but in a special convention. That's where we get the will of the peoples of the states. One at a time that was done. So in case after case, we see that the states were exercising sovereign powers, the states preceded the federal government. So we have good reason to believe that the states were indeed independent sovereigns, and they had simply voluntarily, for a particular period of time, relinquished certain powers. All right, now let's see. Let's zip on ahead. Because later in this piece, we have the author talking about there being one people. He quotes another person summarizing James Madison. That's not a good thing, right? Quote Madison. Don't quote some guy quoting Madison. But the guy who's telling us about Madison says, "Only when the people of a given state acted in combination with the sovereign people of other states could there be a legitimate claim of the ultimate sovereign authority of the people." So the claim here is that Madison's view was that only when the states all banded together could they really resist the federal government. And even then, all they could do is, like, issue a petition, like, hey, federal government, please stop what you're doing. But he argues this by saying that when the people of a given state get together with the people of other states, then you finally have the full sovereign authority of the people. But there is no the people, right? This is a fantasy. There's no history of there being one people at any time in U.S. history. We have a collection of societies from beginning to end. That's what it is. So this is just nationalist propaganda. There is no support for this in U.S. history. Now, in terms of the question of James Madison, I will refer you to my nullificationfaq.com, and also I've even memorized the page numbers of my book, Nullification, that deals with Madison, because this comes up so often. pages 288 to 290. James Madison, of course, was the author of the Virginia Resolutions of 1798. And late in life, he tried to claim that, no, this wasn't calling for nullification. And he even tried to claim that Thomas Jefferson never used the word nullification. And so then somebody brought him a copy of the original draft of the Virginia, of the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798, which did include the word nullification, in Jefferson's own handwriting, and so Madison had to back down. So we don't know if this was the effects of advanced age, or whether he had forgotten, or whether he was lying. Who actually knows? But it looks like his memory is not all that reliable about these things. And my friend Kevin Gutzman will be our guest on the program tomorrow. Kevin is the biographer of James Madison most recently. He wrote a book called James Madison and the Making of America. That's a book published by St. Martin's, which is a major publisher, very important. And he is just convinced that Madison is just simply mistelling the history of 1798. But also what matters is not the text. It's not Madison's view of it, of the what the Virginia Resolutions meant. It's what did the legislature that passed it think it meant? Okay, in the same way that what matters in interpreting the Constitution is what did the ratifying conventions think they were ratifying? Well, what did the Virginia General Assembly think it was ratifying? And if you, when you look at, when it approved the Virginia Resolutions, when you look at the debates in the Virginia General Assembly, it's perfectly clear they understood what they were doing, that an unconstitutional law is null, void, and of no force or effect. And so, and in fact, I have, this is on, I've got the book right here. I have a lot of primary documents in the nullification book, and the General Assembly issued an official address to the citizens of Virginia to explain why they had passed this resolution, the Virginia Resolutions of 1798. And it goes on to say that, acknowledging your right to supervise our conduct, we invite your serious attention to the emergency which dictated the subjoined resolutions. Now, Madison, in the early 1830s, tried to claim that all he was saying was that the states had the power to make protests against the federal government, to say, hey, we really wish you'd stop doing this. Well, that's not what it sounds like here in this document. They're saying, this is an emergency that required our issuing these resolutions. Well, what kind of an emergency is it that has them issuing a resolution saying, by the way, don't forget, we have the right to issue a petition if we really get angry? What kind of emergency is that? And of course, people in the 1830s said, wait a minute, James Madison, you're telling us that all you were saying in 1798 was that the states had the right to issue protests? Everybody knew that. Nobody denied that. Like, what is the point of issuing solemn resolutions just to make a point that nobody in his right mind denied? And everybody took you to be saying what you're now denying you're saying 30 years later. Maybe it should have been a little clearer then. So that's a whole separate matter. But he closes by saying, look, Andrew Jackson proclaimed that nullification was a bad thing. What, is Andrew Jackson some infallible oracle? No, Andrew Jackson was refuted by Littleton Waller Tazewell, the former U.S. representative, U.S. senator, and Virginia governor, in his series of newspaper articles that were later collected as a review of the proclamation of President Jackson. Nullification is not unconstitutional. Check out that post of mine, is nullification unconstitutional? But ultimately, that's what it boils down to, folks, here. I mean, these sorts of arguments are not based in history. They're based in defeatism and the idea that, well, the best we can do is sit around and maybe try to amend the Constitution, or try to plead with them, or ask their own courts to turn things around. How's that been going for the past 100 years? You know, why don't you get a little bit of courage, and also be willing to think outside the box, for heaven's sake? For once in your life, think creatively. All right, we are out of time for today, ladies and gentlemen. Join me tomorrow with Kevin Gutzman. Also, make sure and check out nullificationfaq.com and statenullification.com for more information on this stuff. And you can find out about my book, Nullification, at tomwoods.com/books, where for those of you who like signed books, I do have those available, but you can also get a cheap one at Amazon that people have stepped on or whatever. But thanks so much for joining me, everybody. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.